Hello, and welcome to
Killing It
on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I'm Jessica Vosk. And this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer.
And hi, Beth Level.
Well, hello, storytellers.
Oh, Beth.
Two of my favorite women on the entire planet.
Well, she's full of sass and class and truth. Full of sass, class, and truth. And she's with us today. And for all of you who are as obsessed with Beth as we are, you all know that she is a Tony Award winner. She's a star of stage and screen and one of the most, and I say this without any jest or sarcasm, truly the most beloved Broadway stars. But despite your fascinating, amazing career, we do not want to talk about it whatsoever.
Great. Because we have other fascinating things to discuss, and I have a lot to learn, and I am a Twitter anticipation.
A Twitter?
Ooh, a Twitter. A Twitter.
Oh, my. Well, that's one of our best, that's one of our best responses to the career.
You're welcome.
That's why she's who she is.
That's correct.
But today, you're just amazing. Well, as you know, today we're here to discuss true crime. Now, killers, listeners, please, please give a warm welcome to Beth, who pops her true crime cherry with us today. Beth, when we asked you to join us, you told us you, quote, know nothing about true crime. That's correct, right?
Pretty much. Sorry.
Don't be sorry whatsoever.
We're so honored in this room.
No, we're so glad that we can have this moment in time with you. So we want to know, though, do you like anything crime adjacent, like mysteries?
Absolutely. And saying that, having said that to you, I was kind of editing myself at 3 o'clock in the morning. You were like, oh, hang on. Didn't you, all of a sudden you look at the clock and it was 4:30 in the morning because you had to binge watch, what is it? Murder on something beach?
Of Murder on Middle Beach.
I correct myself in that once I get hooked into, you know, we're storytellers. So even though it's a grotesque story, it's still like I am a little addicted to it if I start it. And then, of course, I have to know what happens, who did it, and why. So, I do sometimes stay up till 4:30 in the morning to find out who did it and why.
Turns out you're one of us, and you didn't even know it.
I am. I should have known.
And so, you've said storytellers a couple of times. Is that why you think we theater folk are, I hate to use the word into, because these are horrible things which we have great respect for and the families of these victims, but the fact that we're fascinated by it, why do you think that is?
I think because part of our career, part of our craft is to study, quote unquote, human behavior. And that human behavior is as gross and grotesque as it is so fascinating. And I think we are all also incurably curious. Mm-hmm. So what a great meeting of quote unquote storytelling. It to be curious, human behavior, just, beginning, middle, and end. Who did it? Who does it? It's fascinating. So I think we're drawn to that.
Well, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It makes perfect sense. That's what we have to do for our lives is put our brains in somebody else's brain.
Exactly.
You know, and that's
exactly. Because I've never had to play a murderer. Have you?
No, but I would love to. I mean, I feel like the closest I've gotten, obviously, is Elphaba because they're all like, she's so evil. And then by the end, you're like, yes, I am. So there's no, you know, but really, I would love to be I always tell anyone, any TV film person or really anyone who's willing to write a Broadway show after the Coco passes, if there's a moment where I could be the one who's killed or the killer as a side hustle role, I want it.
Mm-hmm. Kind of cool, right?
I'm and okay. Yet,
I don't want to be the obvious killer. I want it to be at the end of the show or the series, then go, are you kidding me?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Middle-aged woman.
Yeah.
She did what?
What's wrong with her?
Well, I mean, you know, we interviewed Kate Weatherhead, Beth, and I read yesterday that she's going to be one of the writers on Devil Wears Prada. So maybe we could pitch that to her, like a new surprise ending.
A new twist.
A new twist, maybe. Perhaps.
And how cool is it, though? Like, I love this. I love that we are, now that we brought up Kate, now that we have Beth here, I just love women power, girl power.
Amen.
You know,
amen.
Sassy smart ladies. And
on stage, please, sassy smart.
That's right. Sassy smart baby. And before we jump into this story, which many of you probably know from watching the documentaries on it, Beth, I would like for you to confirm that you are indeed from North Carolina.
I am. I was born in Raleigh, North Carolina. So this is where, this is the genesis of this story, correct?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
And you know, I know everyone, you know, get onto that roller coaster, make sure that all of your belongings are tucked into the front, put your hands and feet inside the coaster, because we're going to start this story up. And she's a wild one. So before we begin, we always like to say credit where credit is due. All of our props here are to Wikipedia. We love you, Wikipedia. You're our boyfriend, girlfriend, every friend, husband, wife, and lover. Beth, we are so happy that you are here. You were requested many times. You were requested.
Thank you.
You were.
Oh my gosh. Well, I am truly a Twitter to start my new obsession.
And welcome. We are so glad that we could be the ones.
Thank you.
To help you with this journey. And ladies, gents, killers who follow us, this is the story of Michael Peterson. Now, Michael Ivor Peterson was born on October 23rd of 1943. He is an American novelist who was convicted in 2003 of murdering his second wife, Kathleen Peterson, on December 9th of 2001. So Peterson's case is the subject of the documentary miniseries, The Staircase, which when I watched it, I was a Twitter. Now, Michael was born actually near Nashville, Tennessee, the son of Eugene Ivor Peterson and Eleanor Peterson. And he graduated from Duke University with a bachelor's degree in poli-sci.
Wow.
Or political science. But I felt cool enough to say poli-sci. While there, Peterson was the president of the Sigma Nu fraternity and was the editor of The Chronicle, which is a daily student newspaper from 1964 to 1965. And he attended classes at the law school of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So, after graduating, Peterson took a civilian job with the U.S. Department of Defense, where he was assigned to research arguments supporting increased military involvement in Vietnam. And that year, he also married Patricia Sue, who taught at an elementary school on the Rhein-Main Air Base in Grafenhausen, West Germany. And they had two children, Clayton and Todd. So in 1968, Peterson enlisted in the U.S. Marine Corps and served in the Vietnam War. And in 1971, he received an honorable discharge with the rank of captain after a car accident left him with permanent disability, which I'm going to go and walk out on a limb right now like a little robin and say that disability is lying.
Already.
I know. Beth, we have taken you. We've captured you in our act one.
Well, I'm sorry. Do you see me taking notes?
I love it. This is a little Hermione Granger side of you, which I appreciate. I love it.
Yeah, that is a gen. That is a gen treat. Now, now, years later, during a mayoral campaign, Peterson claimed he had won a Silver Star, a Bronze Star with Valor, and two Purple Hearts. So he had all the medals, but lo and behold, he said he did not have the documentation for them, which I understand because I don't have the documentation for like all of my Tonys and Oscars, but I digress. And Peterson claims that he had received one Purple Heart after being hit by shrapnel when another soldier stepped on a landmine, and the other when he was shot. And he later admitted his war injury was not the result of the shrapnel wound in Vietnam, but was the result of a car accident in Japan where he was stationed after the war as a military policeman. The Raleigh, North Carolina News and Observer said records did not contain any mention of the two Purple Hearts that Peterson said he received. However, military files verified that he received a Silver Star and the Bronze Star Medal with Valor. Okay, so Peterson and his first wife, Patricia, lived in Germany for quite some time. There they befriended Elizabeth and George Ratliff and their two children, Margaret and Martha. And after George's death, the Peterson and Ratliff families became very close. When Elizabeth Ratliff died in 1985, Michael became the guardian of her two children. And after Michael and Patricia divorced in 1987, Clayton and Todd lived with Patricia, and Margaret and Martha stayed with Michael, who then moved to Durham, North Carolina. And later on, Clayton and Todd joined their father. And Peterson wrote three novels based around his experience during the Vietnamese conflict. Now, Peterson also worked as a newspaper columnist for the Durham Herald Sun, where his columns became known for their criticism of police and of the Durham County District Attorney James Hardin Jr. Now, Hardin was the prosecutor of Peterson for the murder of his second wife, Kathleen, which is like a sizzle reel of conflict. Mm-hmm. And in 1989, Michael moved in with Kathleen Atwater, who was a successful Nortel business executive. They married in 1997, and Kathleen's daughter, Caitlin, joined the extended family. of the Brady Bunch, really, that now consisted of Clayton, Todd, Martha, and Margaret.
Okay, so there you have the background of Michael Peterson. And if you could see Beth's face right now, I wish we had a felt family tree where we could move apples at, you know, just so that we could, it's a lot to keep track of, right?
Sure is.
I'm doing my darndest.
You're doing great. So now we've come to the day in question. This is what sort of starts the whole thing. On December 9th, 2001, Peterson called an emergency line to report that he had just found Kathleen unconscious in their Forest Hills mansion. And excuse me, I have to stop there. Beth, do you know where Forest Hills is?
I do not, but I'm like, Forest Hills mansion. Wow.
Fancy. Them. It was fancy pants. So
was
anyway,
it in Forest Hills, was in Durham, probably not Raleigh?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. So going back, you know, he called 911. He had just found Kathleen unconscious in their Forest Hills mansion and suspected she had fallen down, quote, 15, 20, I don't know, end quote, stairs. And if you all watch The Staircase, you've heard that recording. Maybe we'll punch it in here.
One-way emergency. 18 Cedar Street, please. What's wrong? I went to an accident. She's still breathing.
What kind of accident?
She fell down the stairs. She's still breathing. Please come.
Is she conscious?
What?
Is she conscious?
No, she's not conscious.
Okay. Please. How many stairs did she fall down?
Huh?
How many stairs? How many stairs? Calm down, sir. Calm down.
No, 15, 20, I don't know. Please, get somebody here right away. Please.
Okay, somebody's dispatching the ambulance while I ask you questions.
It's a Forest Hills, okay? Please.
All props to the gals over at My Favorite Murder. They did this case for their 100th episode celebration, and they did, in fact, play the tape. And I think Georgia broke it down by saying you can hear him running back toward the spot because he's not standing over the body to help, which some people said, just psychologically, that's strange. Like, you would want to be there in case you could do something to help your beloved is what maybe might be considered a more normal response. But I digress. Anyway, he later claimed that he had been outside sitting by the pool and had come in at 2:40 a.m. to find Kathleen at the foot of the stairs. Now, P.S., it was reported to be about 55 degrees that night. And a lot of people think, oh, there's no way he would be outside at 55 degrees. But what you have to know is they had been drinking, and he was on, I think, bottle number 2 of this point. And as someone who knows her way around a wine bottle, I'm just going to say, fun fact, when you drink, you get hot. Like, your skin temperature goes up, you know, so it's not that part of it is not that far-fetched
to me. It does, but also, can we say something? 55 degrees in New York is like, tank top, I'm going to wear my stilettos and a sassy sandal. And when it's 55 degrees in LA, they're like, you guys, it's so crazy. I feel like,
Beth is nodding. Beth, do you have anything to add?
Down south, 55 degrees, you still have your L.O. Bean puffer on.
There you go.
Okay. So
unless you have a couple bottles of wine and you're feeling fine.
Like, somebody open a window. All right. So now Peterson said she must have fallen down the stairs after consuming alcohol and Valium. Now, toxicology results showed that Kathleen's blood alcohol content was 0.07%. The autopsy report concluded that the 48-year-old woman sustained a matrix of severe injuries, including a fracture of the thyroid neck cartilage and several lacerations to the top and back of her head, consistent with blows from a blunt object, and had died from blood loss 90 minutes to 2 hours after sustaining the injuries. Kathleen's daughter, Caitlin, and Kathleen's sister, Candace Zamperini, both initially proclaimed Michael's innocence and publicly supported him alongside his children. But Zamperini, the sister, reconsidered after learning of Peterson's bisexuality, as did Caitlin after reading her mother's autopsy report. Both subsequently broke off from the rest of the family. Although forensic expert Henry Lee, hired by Peterson's defense, testified that the blood spatter evidence was consistent with an accidental fall down the stairs, police investigators concluded that the injuries were inconsistent with such an accident. As Peterson was the only person at the residence at the time of Kathleen's death, he was the prime suspect and was soon charged with her murder. He pled not guilty. Now the medical examiner...
Beth, how are we doing? How are you feeling?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I'm twirling. You know, I see it. I'm like, wait a minute.
I see what's happening down there.
Bisexual. Yep. That's the first time we've heard that mentioned at all.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. No, keep going. I'm like, yeah. Okay.
She's in.
Then what happened?
She's in.
1.10 alcohol blood level, that's really not, that's very low, correct?
Zero point zero seven is not that much, you know, that's not, yeah. Okay.
And I want to say this to our listeners, when I say, you know, because we don't video these, we Zoom together so we can see each other's reactions. So I like to tell you that, like, Beth's doing math. She's like doing math in her little, in her, she's fixing all these things in her prosecutorial paper. So
I'm ready to take them trial right now. Let's go.
That's it. Sign.
And to that point, we've had some fans say, oh, I wish we could see you. Because we do this for a living, not having to do our hair and makeup.
It's a treat.
It's Christmas for us, you know? Yeah. So thank you for understanding. So anyway, okay. So the medical examiner, Deborah Radish, concluded that Kathleen had died from lacerations of the scalp caused by a homicidal assault. According to Radish, the total of 7 lacerations to the top and back of Kathleen's head were the result of repeated blows with a light yet rigid weapon. The defense disputed this theory. According to their analysis, Kathleen's skull had not been fractured by the blows, nor was she brain damaged, which was inconsistent with injuries sustained in a beating death. The trial drew increasing media attention as details of Peterson's private life emerged. Hardin and his prosecution team attacked Peterson's credibility, focusing on his alleged misreporting of his military service and what they described as a gay lifestyle he led and had kept secret. The prosecution contended that the Petersons' marriage was far from happy, suggesting that Kathleen had discovered Michael's alleged secret life and wanted to end their marriage. It was the main motive that the prosecution offered at trial for Kathleen's alleged murder, the other being a $1.5 million life insurance policy, ding, ding, because
very ding, ding, because
he was having money problems, we found out. Now, according to Assistant District Attorney Frieda Black, Kathleen would have been infuriated by learning that her husband, who she truly loved, was bisexual and having an extramarital relationship, not with another woman, but a man, which, quote, would have been humiliating and embarrassing to her. We believe that once she learned this information, that an argument ensued and a homicide occurred. Now, this wasn't in Wikipedia, but I do remember, I'm just going to explain to Beth, there was talk that she had gone up to Michael's office and opened the top drawer, one of these drawers at his desk, and was using his computer that she allegedly never used. And in that drawer were printed out emails of correspondence that he was having with a gay male escort. And
right.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. So, and she's writing down, she's like, I want to see, like, are there columns? Okay.
Not yet.
All right. So, moving on, the defense argued that Kathleen accepted Michael's bisexuality and that the marriage was very happy, a position supported by Michael and Kathleen's children and other friends and associates. The prosecution said that Kathleen's murder was most likely committed with a custom-made fireplace poker called a blowpoke. It had been a gift to the Petersons from Kathleen's sister, but it was missing from the house at the time of the investigation. Late in the trial, the defense team produced the missing blowpoke, which they said had been overlooked in the garage by police investigators. Forensic tests revealed that it had been untouched and unmoved for too long to have been used in the murder. A juror contacted after the trial noted that the jury dismissed the idea of the blowpoke as the murder weapon.
All right. I'm just trying to visualize what a blowpoke is.
So picture a long brass fireplace instrument that looks like all the other ones, like a shovel and a brush. Right. And you know, fire stoker. But at one end of it, it's almost like a trumpet mouthpiece. Uh-huh. And it's, you know, it's to blow the, you know, to get the embers, lit, essentially. So, yeah, it's like a long golf club, but with a trumpet piece.
I'm telling you, another learning curve has been shattered. I never knew what that was.
Now she knows.
We are going to go back to Germany for a second here. Because this is all getting convoluted very quickly. And that's the part of the staircase that really made me, my eyes just go like, what? Because look, somebody's life is somebody's life. And whatever people are going through is their own thing. Absolutely no judgment here. And however people react to things is however they react to them. However, you don't murder someone.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying that we always talk about that here. We're like, instead of using that blowpoke, honey, why don't you go to therapy?
I don't know.
Like, couldn't you just hang a second? Or you just say, we got it, honey, part ways, honey. You take your half of the Brady Bunch and I'll take mine. So I'm going to take us back to Germany. I want to go back there for a second because we talked about Elizabeth Ratliff, who was very much a very close friend of the Petersons. and she died in 1985. And there was suspicion surrounding her death. What? Now, yeah, get this. She'd also been found dead at the foot of her staircase with injuries to the head.
Stop it.
I can't.
Okay.
Because one must think it is a coinkydink, and it isn't, in my opinion. Now, her death was investigated by both German police and U.S. military police, and an autopsy at the time of her death concluded that Ratliff died from an intracerebral hemorrhage secondary to the blood coagulation disorder von Willebrand's disease, based on blood in her cerebrospinal fluid and reports that she'd been suffering severe, persistent headaches in the weeks leading up to her death. Now, the coroner determined that the hemorrhage resulted in immediate death, followed by Ratliff falling down the stairs after collapsing. The Petersons, by the way, had dinner with Ratliff and her daughters, and Peterson had stayed to help Ratliff put the children to bed before going home. And the children's nanny, Barbara, discovered the body when she arrived the next morning. So Peterson was actually the last known person who was with her to see her alive. So before Peterson's trial in the U.S., the Durham court ordered the exhumation of Ratliff's embalmed body, buried in Texas, for a second autopsy in April of 2003. And arrangements were made for the Durham medical examiner, who had initially performed Kathleen's autopsy, to perform this reevaluation over the objections of defense counsel, who argued that the autopsy should be performed by Texas medical examiners. So the body was exhumed and then transported from Texas to Durham. And the Durham ME found sufficient evidence drawn from the results of the second autopsy, along with new witness statements describing the scene, to overturn the earlier findings. And now they've listed Ratliff's cause of death as a homicide. It's wild. Mm-hmm. It's really wild. So the prosecution declined to accuse Peterson of Ratliff's death, but what they did was they introduced the death into the trial as an incident, giving Peterson the idea of how to fake Kathleen's accident. So, you know, like, he'd been there, done that, and now that's how he did it. And despite police reports that there was very little blood at the scene of Ratliff's death, which I'm guessing they weren't going to charge him with it because they didn't have sufficient evidence here, but the nanny, who was the first person to discover Ratliff's body in 1985, she did take the stand at Peterson's trial, and she testified that there was a large amount of blood at the scene. And another witness testified to spending much of the day cleaning bloodstains off the wall. Girl.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
So yeah. The admissibility of the Ratliff evidence in court was one of the grounds for the subsequent appeal against his conviction. Obviously, his lawyers were like, we're appealing and we're trying to overturn this conviction. So in October of 2002, acting as an administrator of Kathleen's estate, Caitlin, her daughter, filed a wrongful death claim against Peterson. And in June of 2006, he voluntarily filed for bankruptcy. So now it makes me think the life insurance policy was like, big deal. And 2 weeks later, after he voluntarily filed for bankruptcy, Caitlin filed an objection to the bankruptcy. And on February 1st of 2007, Caitlin and Peterson settled the wrongful death claim for $25 million, pending acceptance by all of the courts involved. And finalization of the settlement by the court was announced on February 1st of 2008. But in the settlement, Peterson did not admit that he murdered Kathleen. And how much do you want to bet that she's never seen any of that money?
Mm.
Because when we go back to the OJ trials and the OJ case, those families from the civil suit have still not seen any money from him all these years later.
Right.
So I'm going to go out on a limb here and say she probably hasn't seen any of that $25 million if he voluntarily filed for bankruptcy. So October 10th of 2003, after one of the longest trials in the history of North Carolina, this Durham County jury found Peterson guilty of the murder of Kathleen, and he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. So denial of parole requires premeditation, and despite the jury accepting that the murder was a, quote, spur-of-the-moment crime, they also found that it was premeditated. And as one juror explains it, premeditated not only planning hours or days ahead, but could also mean planning in the seconds before committing a spur-of-the-moment crime. I must agree. Ladies? Huh.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, Beth, I saw you, of course, react to the horrible nature of cleaning up a lot of blood, et cetera. And if you do go back and watch the Staircase documentary.
Oh, you know, that's my agenda.
Yeah, you must.
You must. And I will say one of the most shocking things about it is the excessive amount of blood
on the stairs and on the wall, which sort of looks like, here's the most awful part besides everything else, is that there is blood spatter and then it looks like someone tried to wipe it and then there's blood spatter on top of that. It's just so inconceivable that a fall from the bottom of the stairs could cause this, you know?
Bleeding. No, it's from, let me check my notes. It's from those seven blunt head injuries that were from the blowtorch or whatever that thing is, the blow shovel, the blow prawn thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
I know. Slow be gone. Killing It on Broadway is proud to support A-STEP, artists striving to end poverty. This organization was started by our friend Mary Mitchell Campbell, musical director of Broadway and beyond, who also wrote our theme song,
Killing It. As we all know, the arts are in a challenging time right now in the U.S., and A-STEP has been doing innovative things during this pandemic, including feeding thousands of families, as well as bringing the arts to children. If you are able, please go to astep.org to make a contribution to the Arts Resilience Fund so they can keep killing it by bringing smiles to the faces of children everywhere.
That's astep.org. Thanks, killers.
I know we'll get to this later. We'll talk about our feelings, but I do want to say, side note, we love our fellow podcasters, and who doesn't, right? And Paul Holes, hello, one of the best investigators of all time. But he has a new podcast with Billy Jensen called The Murder Squad. And they talked about this and he was so responsible in his answer. And I'm paraphrasing, but he said, look, I'd have to look at all the documentation. But he said, it does sound consistent with someone essentially grabbing someone's head and banging it against the edge of the stairs, which I thought was interesting to think about. So that's
It's also interesting. What sticks with me is you were talking about having persistent headaches. Is it a coincidence that Elizabeth was having these massive headaches? I mean, is that just not a part of the puzzle, the equation in any way, shape, or form? You know, immediately my TV watching Beth goes, ooh, was she being poisoned? Ooh, was people.
I know.
Or what was happening? What's happening? Anyway, that just that did a little red check flag for me when you said that.
Oh, and also this seems like a really good time to tell Beth and our listeners and know this because we make sure to tell our guests this, that in this particular podcast today, we are all considered doctors of crime. So you are doctor level.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. It is something that you can now add to your special skills. But on top of everything else, like now we're going to be like, hey, Doc B, you know, talk about how you feel about those headaches being persistent and consistent. And I do. I'm always like, who was being poisoned?
And, totally.
And what another coincidence that Peterson was the last person seen with her. Like, who's the he wanted to stay and put the kids to bed. A, that's weird.
Yep.
That's weird.
Well, and Beth, I'm glad you brought up that question because we're getting to one of the theories that has come out subsequent to this trial. And it lends itself to what you're saying, because if this theory is correct in the Kathleen Peterson case, then one would argue it would have to be correct in Elizabeth Ratliff's case. And that seems highly implausible. And that is the owl theory. So she's intrigued. Here we go.
I'm like, ooh, I'm on the edge.
So good. Sorry.
Owl. You said owl.
Owl. Yes. Yeah. That's like awesome. A wise bird. All right. So in late 2009, a new theory of Kathleen's death was raised, that she had been attacked by an owl outside.
What?
Yes, exactly. You have the correct response. So anyway, saying that she'd fallen after rushing inside and being knocked unconscious after hitting her head on the first tread of the stairs. Now, the owl theory was raised by Durham attorney T. Lawrence Pollard, who was a neighbor of the Petersons, not involved in the case, but he had been following the public details. He approached the police suggesting an owl might have been responsible after reading the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation, and that's SBI for short. He investigated their list and findings that a feather was listed on their list. Peterson's attorney had determined that the SBI crime lab report listed a microscopic owl feather and a wooden sliver from a tree limb entangled in a clump of hair that had been pulled out by the roots found clutched in Kathleen's left hand. A re-examination of the hair in September 2008 had found two more microscopic owl feathers. According to Pollard, had a jury been presented with this evidence, it would have, quote, materially affected their deliberation and therefore would have materially affected their ultimate verdict, end quote. Prosecutors have ridiculed the claim, and Deborah Radish, who conducted Kathleen's autopsy, says it was unlikely that an owl or any other bird could have made wounds as deep as those on her scalp. However, Radish's opinion was challenged by other experts in three separate affidavits filed in 2010. Now, despite interest in this theory among some outside advocates, no motion for a new trial was filed on this point in 2009. Now, on March 2nd, 2017, following his Alford plea, and more on that in a bit, Peterson's attorney filed a motion to allow him to pay for a bird expert at the Smithsonian Institution to examine feather fragments found in Kathleen's hair to determine if she was attacked by a raptor. And we don't mean a velociraptor. We mean,
Dr. B, Doc B, give us your thoughts. On her face. Yes, Doc B.
It seems like a waste of everybody's time, money, and interest. An owl? Right. An owl. I mean, an owl, yes, could probably scratch you, but... No. And I'm sorry, did you say Pollard was Peterson's neighbor?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if they were friends. Mm. Anyway, just that's what I'm thinking. I'm so anxious to know what the Smithsonian owl expert said.
I mean, truly, honestly. I mean,
come on.
This is the type of thing where they're like, well, I found one owl.
One microscopic.
You're and like, again, bitch, that came from my pillow, bitch. That came from my pillow that I slept on.
Or I didn't sweep that day. Sorry. I mean, just come on.
And if you go back again and you look at the autopsies of both women and the wound marks, you're going to have to say that Elizabeth was in Germany, was killed by an owl as well.
So let's head in our time machine. We're taking it back to 2010 in August, where we have this retrial hearing. And we're following a series of newspaper articles critical of the SBI. The North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper led an investigation which resulted in the suspension of SBI analyst Dwayne Deaver, who is one of the principal witnesses against Peterson, after the report found his work among the worst done on scores of flawed criminal cases. So a new motion was filed in August of 2010 by David Rudolph, who was one of Peterson's original attorneys, who acted pro bono in proceedings challenging the SBI testimony. Now, Deaver was then fired from the SBI in January of 2011 after an independent audit of the agency found that he had falsely represented evidence in 34 cases, including withholding negative results in the case of Greg Taylor, a North Carolina man who spent 17 years in prison on a murder conviction based on Deaver's testimony. Bloodstain analysis team that Deaver had trained was suspended and disbanded. So in the 2003 Peterson trial, Deaver testified that he had been mentored by SBI bloodstain specialist David Spittle, had worked 500 bloodstain cases, written 200 reports, and testified in 60 cases. During the retrial hearing, SBI Assistant Director Eric Hooks testified that Deaver had written only 47 reports. Spittle testified that he could not recall mentoring Deaver, who, since completing a two-day training course in the 1980s, had testified in only 4 cases, the Peterson case being the third. And the SBI cited the bloodstain analysis given in the 4th case as the reason for firing Deaver. So on December 16th of 2011, Peterson was released on $300,000 bail and placed under house arrest with a tracking anklet. And his release on bond followed a judicial order for a new trial after Judge Hudson found that Deaver had given, quote, materially misleading and deliberately false testimony about bloodstain evidence and had exaggerated his training, expertise, and experience. And former North Carolina Attorney General Rufus Edmiston said that any evidence gathered after Deaver arrived at the scene might be deemed inadmissible in a new trial. So in July of 2014, Peterson's bond restrictions were eased.
Yeah, if you go watch The Staircase, this gentleman, Mr. Deaver, factors in hugely. You know, it's one of a big reason why the prosecution got a conviction. So it was really troublesome.
It just drives me nuts. I don't know how I feel about it. I mean, I still feel like he's guilty.
Well, yes, I agree that he's guilty, but I also understand why, from a point of view of the law,
that he has to be released or a new trial. At the very least.
Sure.
Oh, his poor victim's family, though. Can you imagine how the kids? How frustrating that must. That's not even a great word. That's not a good enough word for it.
Well, it's probably like this devastating thing because your life is on display for everybody and it's public. And then it's like, you know, then you didn't sign up for it. And then everything gets aired like dirty laundry. And it's just, it's probably really painful for someone's mental health. Truly.
Did Peterson go back to his Forest Hills house or did he have to?
Yes. Let me, please. Let me tell you something. No, don't be sorry. That's a great question. And it's why I would urge you to go watch this series, because that's one of the creepiest things about it. He's there with his attorneys, his brother, who is one of his most ardent supporters, his children, and they're sitting there having sandwiches and sodas 7 or 8 feet from the staircase in question, which still has blood stains all over it. And there's something so... It's such a mind bleep to see them getting on with life right next to this crime scene.
Yeah, it's kind of informing, though, isn't it? About their, you know, what do you call it when you just can't connect to something, that you displace it? Anyway, I can't wait to hear what happened.
All right. Well, in October 2014, the court appointed Mike Klinkesum to represent Peterson, replacing David Rudolph, who had been working pro bono on the case since Peterson's conviction was overturned. Rudolph had stated that he could no longer afford to represent Peterson without being paid. On October 14th, 2016, Peterson's request for the second trial to be dismissed was refused, and a new trial was scheduled to begin on May 8th, 2017. However, a news report on February 7th, 2017 indicated that a resolution had been negotiated by Rudolph, once again representing Peterson and the Durham County District Attorney. And finally, on February 24th, 2017, Peterson entered an Alford plea, which is a guilty plea entered because sufficient evidence exists to convict him of the offense, but the defendant asserts innocence, to the voluntary manslaughter of Kathleen. The judge sentenced him to a maximum of 86 months in prison with credit for time previously served. Because Peterson had already served more than the sentence, 98 and a half months, he did not face additional prison time. The court case generated widespread interest in part because of the staircase, which detailed Peterson's legal and personal troubles. 8 45-minute episodes of the documentary were assembled from more than 600 hours of footage. It was directed by French filmmaker Jean-Xavier de l'Estrade and released by Maha Productions in October 2004. The documentary offers an intimate depiction of defense preparations for the trial. It also examines the role and behavior of the press as it covered aspects of the case. The filmmakers started their project within weeks of Kathleen's death and Peterson's murder indictment. Jury selection took place in May 2003, with the case itself going to trial in July 2003. Following the guilty verdict, de l'Estrade interviewed the jurors to find out why they reached their verdict. By and large, the jurors were swayed by the amount of blood Kathleen lost and the number of lacerations, which indicated to them it could not have been an accident. In November 2012, de l'Estrade released a sequel, The Staircase 2, The Last Chance, which premiered at the International Documentary Film Festival Amsterdam. The film documents Peterson's family and his legal team's arguments in seeking a retrial, in which they succeed. In 2019, Michael Peterson released his own account of his life since his wife's death in an independently published memoir, Behind the Staircase. Thoughts, feelings?
I'm pissed. I'm really honestly pissed. I'm pissed.
This man is now out, free and about.
Since
2017.
Yes, that's right. I believe that's right.
All right. And just one clarification for my notes. What is this law that he pleaded? Alfred? What is
The Alfred plea.
Alfred plea. So it's A-L-F-O-R-D. I love your A++, Beth. An Alfred plea. In United States law, is a guilty plea in criminal court, whereby a defendant in a criminal case does not admit to the criminal act and asserts innocence. In entering an Alford plea, the defendant admits that the evidence presented by the prosecution would be likely to persuade a judge or jury to find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And I remember Kathleen's sister getting up and saying, you are guilty. Like, the word guilty was satisfying to her. Mm-hmm. And I guess each side considers it to some degree a win-win because he did not want to admit I killed Kathleen, essentially.
And they do have to check it with the family first. They have to say, are you okay with the fact that he's going to, if we do this plea deal, are you okay with this being what we offer? Because the defendant does it so that they don't have to take it to trial and they don't have to take a risk and a chance of a jury who would obviously say again that he was guilty.
Right.
And Michael, you can see him in the documentary too. He's quite old at this point in the story. And he ultimately says he decided to do this because he didn't want to put his family through this again. You know, this is quite draining and he would be free. I mean, they're drained of money. He is no longer living in that mansion. He has a quite different lifestyle now.
Yeah, I wonder what his, does he have a life now? I mean, is he so well known? Did he move from Durham, North Carolina? Is he in hiding? Can he go to the grocery store? Can he show his face? That's kind of a prison, whether you are incarcerated or not.
He's
fascinating, right?
It is ruinous to your life. I mean,
really, how do you mend that? How do you clear your name? You don't. You really don't. And there's this entire documentary out right now that millions of people have watched,
mm-hmm.
which serves as a time capsule mm-hmm. of exactly what happened.
So to be clear, the three of us think he did it, correct? Am I 100%. Correct?
And I was just thinking, if he did it, which it sounds like there's kind of no doubt, does he truly, truly believe he's not guilty? Or did he do it and just doesn't acknowledge it? Where it doesn't exist as a murder, it actually was an accident. And what he is saying and been pleading for 20 years is actually his truth now. And isn't that just an amazing, interesting psychological study of
That's
someone.
What I love. That's those mm-hmm. are the things that I love about these kinds of like suspension of disbelief in what actually happened. So part of me would even understand if they were in a fight and he accidentally pushed her and she fell down the stairs. Okay. But when you pair in the fact that there were all these lacerations and the amount of blood
that
was there, no, that becomes to me that this could not possibly have been an accident. However, I do think I do think that what you said is correct about you really believing when you have an issue, you know, a psychological issue, you can actually start to believe that it was a total mistake. And maybe that's how he truly feels about it.
I wonder, has he had like a complete psychological evaluation?
I don't think so.
I don't know.
Just curious.
Because after Elizabeth's death in Germany, and this one, I mean, if I were his family members, I'd be like, no, I'm too, dad, I'm a little scared to be around you.
Don't come over.
Please don't.
That's one of the most fascinating moments of the documentary as well. So they were filming this mere weeks after she dies. And when you see David Rudolph, his attorney, find out that there was a murder in Germany, I mean, I think he turns to the filmmaker and says something to the effect of, well, your documentary just got a whole lot more interesting. I mean, can you imagine being the defense attorney having to defend that shit? I mean, wow.
Nope.
See, when I used to want to be a defense attorney until I realized that I could not argue someone's innocence when I knew they were guilty. I just, there is some moral compass that in me does not, and I know plenty of defense attorneys who really do believe their clients, but also collect a very fabulous paycheck. So you just, you're kind of like, I don't think if I were that attorney, I'd do the same thing. I'd be like, well, sir, your documentary got interesting and I need to leave this case.
I have to go. I can't. Yeah, with no bias, actually fairly represent you because I don't believe it.
Yeah. And ooh. and that owl theory thing, I mean.
I want to know what a Smithsonian owl expert.
That should be a follow-up. Yeah. That should be the follow-up here. It's not an effing owl. You know what
I mean? It's not an owl. Because
just
again,
trying to think, growing up in North Carolina, were there killer owls? Were there in North? I don't speak with any knowledge, but I just remember a little, you know, it's a dove, but like the dove sounding. I just can't remember my mother going, get in here. The owls are out. Inside. Oh, not the owls. Get in here right now.
Oh my God. I think that Beth came up with our new merch thing. Not the owls. Not the owls.
Get in here. Get off that bike.
Oh my God.
Jessica, I think that's the ending. I don't think we can top that.
We can't.
Well, thank you. I now have looking forward to such viewing pleasure, for lack of a better word, with the staircase.
Yes, oh, Beth, go I can't wait it. To hear. I want to know what you think about it.
Yeah,
I really want to. I want your thoughts.
Netflix.
And I want to see this man. I want to see this man. I want to see what he looks like. I want to see what his children look like. I want to see what house that. I want to see what the staircase looks
because
like.
Because you know what? When you look at him, very unsuspecting. You really do not think that this person is capable until you're like, something's wrong with his psyche.
Something's not quite right.
It is heartbreaking too to see how much the daughters in particular just do not believe he's guilty, and you're just like, oh no.
And you know what though? You don't want to believe your dad could do that. You just don't want to believe it. And that's the worst part about all of this kind of stuff is that you don't think people can be capable of such heinous acts, especially people who you love. And so when those kinds of things happen, you are forced to either take a long, hard look at this person and your life, or you continue to support them because they're all you know as your parent. It is a devastating thing. But I will tell you, Beth, I think you are going to absolutely freak out when you see this documentary. It's so fun that you have not seen it yet, because now we get to know. We have to do a follow-up of what Beth
thinks. Yes, please. Because now, like, you know, now I'm going at it with such interest and such curiosity as to how anyone could think he was not guilty. I'd love to see the documentary. Yeah. And I love that you say the documentary really is not one-sided. It really tries to represent both sides.
Yeah. Sure, but here's the thing too, like Jen said, you think that the documentary is trying to help Peterson out in this thing until there's so much overwhelming evidence against him that everybody involved is like, oh shit.
Oh,
you know, like, oh, we were, oops. No.
Well, and there's a difference too between, I think the blow poke theory might've been a mistake on the part of the prosecution. I think it happens a lot in cases where there's a difference between the court presenting the case well and correctly and the truth of whether or not they did it or not. You know, they're trying to present the best case, and certainly a hole gets blown in their boat with the whole blow poke being found. So it's amazing they got around that and still achieved a guilty verdict in light of that. But it, as far as just the truth, yeah, I think he's guilty, you know, but.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Anyway.
No doubt.
Anyway, Beth Lovell, thank you so much.
Thank you, my friends. That was fascinating.
Can't wait to see you in person and give you a hug. Love you.
Yes, please. I love you, girls.
Beth, this is our 25th episode. Your episode is number 25. Oh. So thank you. We're so honored to have such a fancy pants person on to celebrate our number 25. So thank you.
Oh my God. You're so welcome. And I can't wait to see everybody in person. And I can't wait to see you on in company.
Oh, me too.
Thank you. Thank you. Love you. Okay. Bye-bye.
I cannot wait to watch this. Adam!
Oh. Hey, it doesn't get better than Beth Lovell.
You know, just nobody does it better than Beth. Makes us feel like guilt is right. And that, you know, listen, this is a crazy case. We've been chomping at the bit to discuss this case with someone. And I truly think there's no one better than Beth Lovell to talk about it. On top of the fact that she is going to be a novice to this documentary. So she didn't even come in having seen it. And now she's our, like, she's our little note taker, and she's going to go with her notes to this documentary guaranteed. And we have to get a follow-up of her. So killers, make sure that we get a follow-up of Beth's reaction. We need to post it. She couldn't be more amazing in general. And it was such a pleasure to have her here today. And we love her. And that means that we also love you, killers. It's just in tandem, we feel it. And we thank you, thank you, thank you for coming to our 25th anniversary episode, which means that we've just done 25 of these, but God bless. And until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content, and follow us on Instagram at Killing It on Broadway and Twitter at Killing It on B-Way.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It on Broadway is a production of Killing It on Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.